How are you? Where are you? Are you in, where are you?
I'm at home. I'm in Colorado.
Cool, cool, cool.
Being home, which is nice. You've been flitting about places.
I am still flitting about. Yeah, I am in Umberto, Italy right now, and then I will be in France and New York before eventually coming home at the very end of July. And so
And now, do you have to quarantine between European countries or not?
no, so the way that it, because I have, well, actually, I don't know if it's because I have the vaccine. I think because I have the vaccine, and I was on a COVID-free flight coming into Italy, which means I ended up having four PCR tests in like a 48-hour span to prove, two on both, no, three on the state side and one as soon as I landed in the airport in Italy. And then, when I go from Italy to France, I will have a PCR test here before I leave. And provided that's negative, they'll let me on the plane. And then in the airport at Charles de Gaulle, they'll also give me another one when I land. And provided that's negative, they let you into the country.
Okay. So
Yeah, sorry.
the
Those are
future
maybe
is
more.
mobile. The future is
Yeah,
mobile
yeah,
with
yeah.
nasal swabs.
Yeah, 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 yeah. And they're like, I mean, like I said, I had four and I said 48 hours. It was actually more like probably 36 hours. So my nose was like raw at the end of that. I don't know how many you've had, but they're not
Enough.
great. I don't love,
I feel
yeah. I
like,
don't
yeah.
love them.
But being able to be in France and Italy, maybe a trade-off worthwhile.
Oh, totally, totally. Yeah, I mean, it's incredible. I was a total rube. My dad worked on a duck farm my whole life, and so we were pretty well yoked to the place that we were. I had never left the country save going to Canada, until, I mean, it was after we came to America. I'd never left the country save going to, Canada a couple times, and then my book came out, and off poems, it's the most incredible thing, that I should be able to write enough sentences to be able to get to see the world is something that I don't think I'll ever quite get the hang of that, or get used to that fact.
What do you think causes the hunger for poetry that allows that translation from you writing sentences to you going to see people in the world to share your poems?
Yeah. Do you mean the intrinsic hunger for poetry within myself, or the hunger for poetry that catalyzes people to ask me to come, bang my pots and pans?
I think I was going for the latter, but I'm interested in the former also.
Yeah, I mean, and the writing itself is an end in and of itself. I was doing it long before anyone cared that I was doing it. I spent a great many years, writing poems that nobody read unless I, really forced it upon people and da 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 da, as I'm sure that you and every other poet who's ever existed has. That has been more or less a constant in my life since, I mean, my mom has poems or has pictures of poems now. My parents try not to keep too much stuff, so they don't have the physical artifacts, but they have pictures of poems that I wrote when I was like 4 and 5 years old. Some of my earliest writing in the English language is poetry. But in terms of the hunger for poems, just as a human enterprise, or the hunger for encountering illumination that is not of yourself. I mean, that's the age old, I mean, that's just art, that's just our species's desire for narratives, and our brains got too big for our heads. Our heads couldn't get any bigger, or we wouldn't be able to get born. So we invented this technology of language and writing, so that it's sort of the third lobe of our brains, right? That we just keep in libraries. And that's as old as language.
I feel like it would be impossible to talk about Pilgrim Bell without talking about language and the ways that language allows us these really incredible intimacies and connections and communications and revelations, but also the barriers that language sets up and the opacity of it sometimes and the untranslatable realities from language to language and heart to heart. Can you talk a little bit about why that became a central concern of this book for you?
Yeah, that's such a beautiful question. Thank you for spending, I mean it, what a great fan of yours and your work on and off the page, and just your person that I am in this world and in this life. And so the idea that you spent real good time with this book tickles me so much. I mean, this is, I don't know when this will be coming out. So maybe the book will be out by the time this comes out. But when we're speaking right now, this book isn't out yet. And so not a lot, I haven't spoken with a lot of people who have spent time with it. And so I don't know, it makes me feel really, really good and whole and right that you're one of the first readers. And one of the first people with whom I'm talking about it. I've spent so much time sitting at the foot of you, sitting at your feet, and sitting at the foot of your language, just sort of learning what I can, and sort of the slack jaw wonder. And it's really cool to be able to talk about this book with you. To go to your question, the idea that we are making art with this technology, meaning specifically the English language, which was man-made. It didn't just like land on us, right? I mean, we invented it, and by we, I mean men specifically invented it. And it bears all the flaws of its makers, right? I mean, it's pound for pound, I think a strong case could be made for it being the most violent technology mankind has ever invented. I mean, it's been used and deployed to perpetuate and insulate the building and deployment of nuclear weapons and chattel slavery, and carrying us to the brink of irreversible ecological collapse and genocide and colonization and all of humanity's greatest hits, right? The English language specifically has enabled or bolstered, right? And so it seems particularly ghoulish that I am this person who has sort of deputized myself warden of my species' most dangerous technology, and have said I am going to use this to make beauty and to search for meaning, right? Using this extremely corrosive and irreparably violent technology, right? And there's so much that, because of its history, can't be done with it. The poet M. Nergesa Philip, who is who's a major presiding spirit over so much of the thinking in this book, talks about the need to decontaminate the English language, and that word has been really useful for me in my wondering and wandering around some of this stuff. It's like how to how, I mean, what does that work of decontamination look like, right? If you're using the language as intended, that's not particularly decontaminatory, and in fact, it's likely reinscribing some of the violences intended by its makers, right? And so there has to be some subversion of the willful intent of its makers. And I think, I think that people like M. Nabessa Philip and Solmaz Sharif and Natalie, who just won the Pulitzer, which I'm very excited about, and you and Ross and Ilya, and I mean, there, the list goes on of people who have been thinking around these things long before me. So I'm just sort of, I'm just sort of following along and trying to add my little whisper into this conversation that has preceded me and will go on long after the last person has forgotten my name, you know?
Yeah. I'm going to do a little sideline. You mentioned Ilya Kaminsky and Ross Gay and Natalie Diaz, whose post-colonial love poem was just named a Pulitzer winner. But I know it's so exciting. But I want to return to Philip's book Zong, which is, oh, it's such a book. And I'm thinking a lot right now in my role as Orion editor about just making sure to make Orion poetry editor of just making sure to keep exciting and perhaps slightly unexpected books
Totally.
on our readers' radars. And I feel like Zong would be a great book to talk about.
I mean, I think that because you had, you had mentioned in your work as the Orion poetry editor, trying to include sort of unexpected texts. And I think that this is something that I've learned from you. I also work as an editor at The Nation, and I have worked variously as in a million different editorial capacities over the years. And one of the things that I've definitely learned from you is, from your Black Nature anthology, which is like one of my favorite anthologies that I know of, poetry anthologies that I know of, and one of my most frequently gifted and recommended, is that, curatorially, you're not just like having poems or someone, looks out on a landscape or like odes to, a flower or da 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 da, like the your conception of like what it means to write an ecological poem is much more expansive than that, right? Or a nature poem or whatever is much more expansive than that. And that's something that I think about a lot. And so yeah, I mean, I think that Zong is actually a really interesting book, in this conversation. You're thinking about water, you're thinking about people who built the land on which we live. You're thinking about the people who colonized the land on which we live, built the country on which we live, not built the land, but built the country on which we live. But yeah, I mean, the way that that book, there's a quote that I think about a lot from the musician Brian Eno. Wrote a book called A Year of Swollen Appendices, where he talks about the crack in a blues singer's voice. Like if you're listening to, excuse me, like a Billie Holiday record or a Sarah Vaughan record or something, and their voice cracks on the vinyl. He calls that the sound of an emotional event, too momentous for the medium assigned to record it, too momentous for the medium assigned to record it. And I think that the story of Song, right, the ship and the people who were murdered on it, for insurance money, is an emotional event too momentous for the English language, right? There's nothing that can be said about that that will equal the ghoulish horror of the events, right? And so what Nabessa Philip does is take the legal transcripts of the case and create this kind of like divinatory oracular experience that pulls the actual language from the case, and doesn't necessarily break the language. It's not the language itself that's being fractured. I mean, it is, it's being, rearranged, but it's still the same language as the source, right? But what she's displacing is the sort of temporal context in which the language happens, right? Which is to say, this is the language of the court case. Nabessa Philip has a background as a lawyer, and so this is the language of a court case, which presumably, to all parties involved, must have been very sort of reasonable. You know, she does this in Discourse on the Logic of Language too, right? And with the language of the edicts on in the right column, which is a is in a different book, but where she is displacing not necessarily the language itself or the syntax, but displacing the temporal context of the language. Because again, in its time, this language was, I'm sure, perfectly reasonable to all parties encountering it, right? The people who were encountering this language were like, yeah, we should be arguing about, you know, this is a, you know, a reasonable thing to be talking about, right? And a reasonable way to be talking about these human lives. But of course, now, you know, to the contemporary American poetry reader, you know, that ghoulishness is foregrounded because of that temporal displacement, right? And so it's that fracturing, it's that temporal fracture, that amplifies the insufficiency of the language, right? That shows that there is an emotional event too momentous for the language assigned to record it, right? She does that again. I mean, she does that a million different ways, right? I mean, even in like Discourse on the Logic of Language, each one of the you know, three columns of text sort of treat that differently. But anyway, she's, you know, she's one of the brightest sort of stars in the constellation of the sky of this book. She actually blurbed it. It wasn't on the galley that went out, but it's on the final copy, which I actually haven't seen yet. My spouse Paige has a final copy, but because I'm in Italy, it hasn't gotten to me yet. But she's like the top. I mean, the idea that she like held this book in her hands and said something about it, just like, you know, it's one of those things that just sort of immobilizes you.
Well, it's an exciting thing to have these moments where you realize that the kind of intimate, personal, even if they are very, very large and global, they still happen inside your head, inside your body and mind. And to have those reach out beyond you and into the body and mind of those you admire and strangers and people all around, it can feel wonderful, but it can also sometimes feel very overwhelming, I think, because of the idea of the efficacy of language, really, what language can do to communicate beyond, right? That can be with great power, that great responsibility also that comes with it. So I thought that there was one aspect of this book I really, really do want to talk about, which is how playful it can be sometimes, even as it's being very serious. The kind of wit that carries through, not belly laugh wit, but I would very frequently sort of smile and shake my head in approval of the way that you game my expectations and you force me to look at something more carefully or to look and look again or to look in the mirror to be able to understand what it is that I see on the page. And those kinds of moments in the book are, I think, really wonderful. And also, I wondered if they are a mode of action or protection or a desire towards reaching into a new kind of telling, or maybe all of the above.
I mean, you just said it as well. I mean, I can't improve upon what you just said. Yeah, I mean, thank you for saying that. You know, I think that I am a very sort of self-conscious person broadly, and in certain ways, especially as it pertains to presuming to say anything about ethics or morality, when I am so compromised by all of the systems that compromise everything else around me, right? And so, you know, I'm not immune to the corrosive impact of empire. In fact, I'm part of it, right? And I'm not interested in writing a book that says, like, look at all these bad people around me, and aren't you glad that I'm here to tell you about them, right? I think a more honest book is like, isn't it wild that we're all so compromised, right? And I think that, so I think, you know, a lot of the wit that you're describing is just sort of me calling myself out throughout the book. You know, the parts of the book that that feel interesting to me in the way that you're describing are, you know, when I get into talking about something and then I'm like, wait a minute, I do that too, you know, or you know, there's a moment, for instance, in a poem called The Miracle, where I'm talking about the angel Gabriel, and then, you know, halfway through the poem, I'm like, wait a minute, like, why are we calling him Gabriel when, like, in the Muslim tradition, we would call him Jibril, right? His name in Arabic and in the Quran, Jibril, right? Gabriel is like the Anglicization of that, right? It's like what Christians call this, and it's the same angel, right? But I'm using like this Western, I don't even like the word Western because the earth is a sphere and, you know, everything is west of everything else. And if you say Western, then you're putting the center in Europe. But, you know, like, but, you know, and like in the middle of the poem, you know, I'm like, you know, I sort of say like, if, you know, if you can't, if the angel Gabriel showed up, like, would you call him Jibril or Gabriel like you are here? And then like, who is this poem even for? Right? Like, who, like, are you writing this for you? Or are you, you know, and like, it's not like, yeah, it's like you said, you know, it's not funny, haha, but it is like this moment of like, wait a minute, like, what are we doing? You know? And I think that a younger version of me, the poet, would have just changed the Gabriel to a Jibril, right? Or, you know, left it a Gabriel, you know, whatever. I would have deliberated about that. But I think that the honest thing is to leave in that ugly moment, right? And I think that that kind of ugliness can be disarming, and it can be sort of funny in the way that you kind of laugh when you're uncomfortable, right? It makes me uncomfortable, right, to call myself out so fully. But I do think that that is, I think it's important to how the book works. And maybe that's something.
It is something, and I think it's also really important how the book forms connection between, you the poet and the work, but also me the reader and the work. So you, I was lucky to see a draft of the final poem in the collection or part of it long ago. You shared with me part of the palace, and I maybe even like a year and a half ago, and I've not touched my salad spinner without a
That's
recollection of
exactly the
that
same thing.
poem
It's exactly the same
since.
thing, though. It's exactly the same thing.
Right? And so these kind of moments, these actual objects in the real world, these moments of an actual certainty or lack of certainty, or the kind of poet popping up, deliberating about word choice or the mistranslation, or my father would say that this is said this, but this other mind I respect says this. Like those moments of real life that show up in the poem, then walk with me in my real life as I move outside of the poem. And so that's exciting. And I feel like that, okay, this is another bridge to the next question, this idea of your mind's journey walking with me through the day. Can you talk a little bit about the title, Pilgrim Bell, and what you hope to signal with that title? I see this idea of pilgrim and pilgrimage and this desire not just to show up and be at the place of spiritual reckoning and awakening and awareness, but to journey to it.
Yeah,
And
totally,
like
totally,
the kind of
absolutely.
the path of coming to this moment of reckoning and awakening is as important as the showing up there and the bell telling me to come and to walk, right? Like that's what I saw in the title as I kind of moved through the poems, but I'm
Yeah.
also curious to hear what you're hoping with that title and then the series, right, where we get those poems returning again and again.
Yeah, I mean, again, you've said it. I should just have you like I'm glad that we're recording this so I can just like listen back and then like try to memorize the things that you're saying so that I can sound as smart as you sound when I talk about this book. Yeah, I mean, you know what you said. I mean, maybe what I can say is that everything that you said, absolutely. I mean, they're just two words. Honestly, they're two words that fascinate me. Which is maybe like a goofy thing to say, but they're two words that really, really fascinate me. And a pilgrim is someone who is on this kind of journey, right? There's the Anne Carson quote that says a pilgrim is someone who's up to something, right? And obviously I'm interested in this kind of pilgrim's journey, the unselfconscious seriousness implied by that, right? The way that like a pilgrim isn't, there's I think that one of the things that this book really wants to be is sincere. And one of the things that this book really wants to avoid is foguish irony. And I think that the default posture of the public intellectual is irony. And I think that that's not particularly interesting to me right now. Or it's not interesting to this book. And to say something and mean something else, I'm interested in like how to make poems where I'm just saying the thing that I mean. I'm saying the thing that I mean, right? And I think that the kind of earnestness to which we that's a problematic first person plural, but to which I think the most popular kind of earnestness that is being traded around right now. Is this kind of like, this tactical exchange of non-secret secrets, where we sort of say like, I don't know about anyone else, but I think that Iranians are decent people, and it's like, and it's the sort of statement that is like framed in this rhetorical structure as if like someone would disagree with it, right? But like no one to whom you're speaking is actually going to disagree with that statement. You know what I'm saying? And so it's like rhetorically framed as if it's this kind of like rhetorical, as if it's this kind of like reveal, but actually like nothing is being risked. It's not actually a sort of like advance in intimacy in any way, right? And there's something in the, I was just at Assisi here in Italy, and just like watching the actual pilgrims, the pilgrims and the monks in the sort of Franciscan robes at the at in Assisi, right? The sort of town from which Saint Francis hails at his basilica. And just like how little they cared, what anyone, no one, none of those Franciscan monks in the robes gave a shit what I was doing, or like that I was writing a book, or whatever, none of them cared what I was up to. They were absolutely serious and absolutely unironic about the way that they were practicing devotion, right? And I think that there's something really, really beautiful and about that. And I also think that there's something just so humbling about that, right? There's something that sort of like absolutely disarming lack of irony, I think, is so humbling and beautiful, and something that I mean when I say things like God and love and fear. And those are the things that this book is about. Does that make sense? Oh, and then a bell. A bell is a devotional technology that that requires the heft of a body to make it move, right? Like you have to pull on the rope of the bell to make it sound, right? And in that way, it just reminds me a lot of a poem, right? Like there has to be some physical process, whether it's a pen moving on the page, whether it's the ocular muscles moving the eye across the page for a sighted reader, or you know, the hand moving across the braille for a non-sighted reader. You know, there has to be some physical process that animates the poem, right? That makes the poem more than just a font or ink on a page, right? You know, the muscles of the throat passing, and the diaphragm passing the air through the lungs and through the throat out the mouth, right? And the tongue, as a muscle of articulation, again, which is something that Discourse on the Logic of Language speaks about more brilliantly than I'll ever be able to touch. But you know, that is one of the ways in which the bell is really, really interesting to me.
That's beautiful. I'm sorry, I thought
No, you're fine, you're fine.
just a couple days ago, actually, my daughter, who just turned 11, I
Wow, that's
know, right?
nuts. I remember when she was like, I remember seeing pictures when she was like, you know, just, you know, barely even a child, you know, like in the on the threshold from like toddler to child, you know.
I
That's crazy.
know. It is
Wow,
it's
11. What is
another way
she?
to understand time.
Yeah. I bet that like really, really strangers your relation, defamiliarizes your relationship to time. What does she love right now?
Doing very little.
That's good. That's good. Yeah,
Right?
the
I
summer
think
is a time for this.
it's
Yes.
just such an extreme year on
Yeah,
so
sure.
many levels, and of course she's still not vaccinated. And
Yeah.
so it really hasn't the agitation hasn't entirely stopped. And so
Sure.
it's been interesting to just watch kind of her answer to it is to it's to read and to draw and to like make crafts and to just kind of
Sounds like
be
she's doing a lot.
quiet.
Yeah,
Right,
sure.
it
Yeah.
is. It's all this kind of in more internal kind of activity as opposed to that kind of big out and about activity. It
Sure.
feels like watching a creature who like watching a diurnal creature.
Yeah.
Kind of spin through the two modes of, okay, I'm out and about doing my thing in the world, and then you kind of don't, they pull back, and it's not like they just go to sleep the rest of the time. They're just back closer to their den, taking care of themselves.
Yeah. I love
So,
that. That's beautiful.
but the other day she had a bell that happened to have been a bell that the bell hooks had given her. And I know,
Wow. Wow.
right?
What a flex.
And
What a
she figured
flex.
out
A
how
bell
to
hooks bell. Wow,
a
wow, wow,
bell
wow,
hooks
wow.
bell, right?
Yeah, that's crazy.
She figured out how to silence the clapper by
Huh.
putting a magnet on the wall, and so the clapper pulled to the magnet, not to the wall of the bell. And it was just like what like where did that come from? This desire to kind of figure out how a bell works and how to get on top of how the bell works to create your own power and force in it. I was
That's
like, all right,
crazy.
you go.
Yeah. Wow. That's wild.
It was kind of interesting to watch.
Yeah.
But we're supposed to be talking about you and your book.
No, no,
And
no, no. I mean, we're talking about,
again, like,
yeah.
I feel like this is like this fits though, because all those Pilgrim Bell poems, I want to talk to you. I'm always really interested in talking about craft, right? That I feel like with a poet like you, a poet like me, what so frequently happens is that we talk about the ideas of the work, and the
Yeah, well, I
ideas are
think that,
so important. They're so important, but
yeah.
like there is something happening here with the landscape of the line, with how you're using punctuation, with how you're using syntax, and how those are part of what you're saying, right? How you're saying is part of what you're saying. So, like, in light of like the how to stop the clapper from moving, all those Pilgrim Bell poems are syntactically ruptured over and over and over again, but they're not grammatically ruptured. And so I just want to talk about that. Like, why?
Why are you doing that? Yeah, I love this story about like the stop clapper and the magnet. That's beautiful. And that's like I wish I had landed upon this like as a metaphor or a practice like a year ago when I was still working on this book. They're sort of aggressively punctuated. I'll say that I didn't just want to write Calling a Wolf a Wolf too, my first book. I didn't want to just write a bunch of, and so much of that book worked with this kind of super saturation of language and punctuation, and I'm sorry, not of punctuation, but of language and these rushes of unpunctuated language. And my life was that book. I wrote those poems very sort of urgently and very much like clinging to sort of 2x4 out in the middle of the ocean, right? They sort of feel like that, right? Because that's sort of where I was at in my life when I was writing them. And I found that what after that book came out and I started writing poems again, I was kind of just writing poems that sounded like that still, right? But they just didn't like what felt new and exciting to me formally in that book just kind of felt old hat and rote to me after that book had come out, right? And so in an effort to sort of push myself towards the opposite of like the long unpunctuated line, I was started like writing these poems with like aggressively punctuated lines, right? Excessively punctuated, excessively stoppy lines, which is sort of where some of those experiments were where some of those first lines emerged. And then, it became really interesting. So much of this book is thinking about how to, I mean, was me trying to teach myself, honestly, not even just thinking about, but trying to actively learn and grow along sort of psycho-spiritual lines, but trying to learn how to sit in mystery without trying to resolve it, and to sit in uncertainty without trying to resolve it. And to me, it felt a little bit like the period is sort of like a grammatical demarcation of certainty, right? Like this is the end of the thought, right? Subject, object, verb, or subject, verb, object, right? Right. This is the end of the unit, right? And so, when I put a period at the end of a line, but then the grammatical sentence continues after the period, it's like the urgency of the language is sort of superseding the impositions of certainty, right? The my attempts to denote visually like this sort of grammatical demarcator of certainty is being subverted by the language itself, which again, as a kind of spiritual practice, felt useful for me, felt maybe sort of emblematic of some of the work that the book was doing on the whole, right? Like a little miniature synecdoche of the work that the book was doing on the whole, right? I always sound a little bit like I always feel like when I talk like this, it's a little bit bullshit, because like these things, it's not like I was sitting there being like, wow, what a great subversion of visually demarcated grammatical certainty I just came up with, right? But like but as I began to work with it and as I began to play with that form more and more, I realized that that's what I was doing, right? It wasn't like I was it wasn't like I began sort of intellectually thinking like what can I do to create a synecdoche of this larger thing that the book is doing. But once I sort of landed upon this formally and began playing with it and working with it, I realized that that's what it was.
Yeah. I think that's a beautiful explanation for what it's doing,
I appreciate that.
And it aligns with how it felt in the
good,
reading.
Good. That's exciting. So. That's really cool to hear. That's really lucky to hear, because again, like, I haven't talked to a lot of people. You know, Paige has read this book, and you know, my editor Jeff has read this. You know, I mean, there are a handful of people with whom I've spoken about this book, but by and large, you know, it's still very much like, I don't know how people are gonna encounter those poems and if they sort of land and how they, you know, it's refreshing to hear, you know, someone I admire. I don't mean to just like spend this whole time like being like really cloying or sycophantic or anything, but you know, you know how much I admire your work and yeah, it just
and
makes
now
me
the
feel
world
good.
Can know it too, which is important.
Now
the world
now
should
it's on
know
the
it.
Record. Now it's on the record. Yeah. Totally. That's great.
So I mean, this is for Orion. This conversation is for Orion, and there's this expectation that Orion is this. It's about environmental minded people. It is nature, but it's also nature, culture, place is one of the taglines that frequently comes up connected with Orion. So I mean, where do you think Pilgrim Bell specifically falls in those concerns? Why do you think this book is a book that would be important for the typical Orion reader to come upon?
Yeah. I mean, I would never presume to say anything that I've written is important for anyone to come upon. you know, I would, you know, there are a lot of really good books out there, you know, and you know, I think that this is a book, but you know, I have no idea, who, if anyone needs it or, you know, besides me, you know, I needed it, but, can you imagine how immobilizing that would be though? Like if you sat down and you were like, I'm going to write the poem that people need right now, right? Like how, I mean, you know what I mean? Like what would that even look like?
Right. It would be hard to figure that out, I believe. Yeah.
And who would presume to be able to write that poem? Sorry.
A very presumptuous person, I think.
I'm saying.
But also, because we are in a moment of such urgency on so many fronts, earlier you listed a whole bunch of them, this kind of ecological crisis and global political crisis and the violence of declared and undeclared war and all these of this pandemic, all these things that we are living in, it does feel like if I'm going to take the time to write, I need to take some time to do something that's of value to others. That's not just about me and what I need. And so that is also happening, right? The sense that I can't pretend to write the necessary thing, but I have to write something that is necessary if I'm going to take this time.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the way that I think about it is just that language being the technology that it is and having the history that it has, this language in particular, though, you know, I mean, Farsi is a colonial and colonized language as well, right? But this language, the English language we're using to talk to each other right now, being what it is, I think, makes incumbent upon me the need to take it seriously, to take my material seriously, right? And again, like I just don't think it's for me to say, you know, that my work is or could be or will be or could ever be or would ever be or has ever been useful to anyone else, right? That's just, I mean, I can tell you, I could, you know, I could talk to you for days about the writers whose work has been useful to me. Right. But you know, it's just not for me to say, you know, that about my own work. But But I do think that we, you know, the poet Tomas Soloman, the Slovenian poet, great, great Slovenian poet. I met him once in my MFA. I think it was my first year of my MFA. And you know, this is a man who has seen, you know, all manner of war and atrocity, and just, you know, I mean, he's really been through all of the darkness that life has had to offer, and was still this sort of like indomitably gregarious spirit. And I remember I was talking to him because, you know, he would just sit and talk to you. And I was talking to him, and he said, you know, a poem can be playful and it can be silly and it can be fun and funny, but a poem must never be frivolous. And I remember just like hearing that and being like, whoa, like I don't think at the time I really quite understood what he meant by it, you know, because his poems, you know, he's a very, I mean, he's a poet that many people call, you know, playful and strange and these things, you know, and you know, and his poems aren't for everybody, but over the years I've thought about that so much. And I think that the difference between like a fun poem and a silly poem and a poem that makes you laugh and a frivolous poem is that a frivolous poem is one that doesn't take its material seriously, right? Like when you think about, you know, all the, you know, we have all these poems that have caused all this trouble, you know, and that, you know, have used language violently, and that people have rightly sort of pointed to and condemned over the past few years. And I think that the thing that they all have in common is that they didn't take their material seriously, right? They didn't consider the long histories of certain words and certain pieces of language, right? And so, yeah, I mean, to the extent that that I have something in my head, like you have to write something useful, right? I mean, again, I begin the writing because it's just the best sort of psycho spiritual technology that I have for navigating my living, right? But when I think about like what I put into the world, right? That's what I'm thinking about, right? Have I taken my materials seriously, right? Not like, is this going to be useful? Like, will people, you know, weep when they read this? Or will people, you know, line up to tell me how brilliant I am when they read this? But have I taken my materials seriously?
I love that. And I love that. I guess I love this, that partially connecting back to something we talked about in the first half of the interview about the way that you use wit and the way that I would sometimes just smile when I had to hold the book up to the mirror to see the poem, or when I had to, when I'd hear something translated and retranslated, and I would find new things, and the kind of playfulness even of your syntax sometimes, that I keep using the word playful, but it's not, again, it's not like a belly laugh kind of thing, and it's not frivolous. It's that kind of serious humor of an intense meaning, that the kind of humor that makes you look and look again, right? And that seems like a thing that we need, right? That an audience needs, that a community needs, but it only works when the speaker needs it also.
Yeah, I love that's beautiful. That's beautiful. I love that.
So there's a duck farm in this book. There's, you know, there's some other kinds of markers that we might consider kind of capital N nature sort of thing, but it doesn't feel, you know, it doesn't It's definitely not a pristine book. It's definitely not a kind of American Wilderness collection or things like that. And I don't even remember if there were any trees in it, you know, or flowers, right?
Let
Like,
me, I don't know. It's interesting.
how do you think, what are your thoughts about environment? What are your thoughts on greater than human nature and the way that those play into your own work or not?
It's such a good and beautiful question, and one that, again, I think is one that any writer worth their salt is asking themselves or ought to be. I mean, I don't like speaking in ought to be's, but probably most all of them are. One thing that I can say is that, I have the great fortune of having conned the universe into letting me be married to transcendent American poet Paige Lewis, who is just so good at seeing the world. And that sounds corny, but when they see a tree, they really, really see the tree, right? Like they see like actually that tree, like they could go on a walk and then come back home and like draw a tree that they saw like from memory, you know what I mean? Like they actually see the tree and not just the idea of a tree, right? Whereas, left to my own devices, like I go on runs all the time, and I run past the same trees, every day here. And there's not one of them that I could close, that I could like just without looking at it, like with a sheet of paper, draw with acuity, right? Draw with precision, despite the fact that I intellectually know that, it's pulling light from a star that lives 93 million miles away and turning that into glucose, that weighs something, like turning light that weighs nothing into glucose that weighs something. Like that's literal magic, right? And despite the fact that I intellectually know this, when I look at the tree, I don't see the tree, right? When I look at the pigeon, I don't see the pigeon. Or when I look at the spider, I don't see the spider, right? I see the idea of the spider. I see other spiders that I've seen before, right? But Paige, being around Paige, makes me really, really see things, right? And we go on a lot of walks, and we spend a lot of time in nature, and we go on a lot of hikes and this sort of thing. And I just spend a lot of time looking at the world, or more accurately, looking at them look at the world. And I think that that practice of awareness has inflected everything. It has inflected everything in the way that I see. I was gonna add a direct object to that, but just the way that I see, it reminds me to actually look at the thing that I'm looking at and not the idea of the thing. And I think that that is everywhere apparent in the book. I think that that is, the practice of walking with Paige and learning to see birds the way that they see them, or to see flowers the way that they see them, right? Even if I'm not literally writing about that flower, right? Like, here is my poem about that flower, right? The way that I have learned to look at that flower has shaped the way that I have learned to look at myself or my country or my language, right? Does this make sense?
And how long has, I'm always interested in when two poets cohabitate and share their work and things, the ways in which the each person's work will inform the other poet's mode of being, and then also the ways that the poets kind of stay very much
And
their own
resist out.
humans,
Yeah,
right?
totally, totally, totally.
So how much do you think Paige's way of being in the world has influenced the shift in the ways that you're writing in Pilgrim Bell compared to how you were writing in
Wow, that's
Wolf?
such a good question. That's such a good question. That's such a beautiful question. I mean, calling a wolf a wolf, I was like, again, like First of all, the oldest poems in that book began before I even met Paige. I met Paige probably like a year, I think, into sobriety, maybe like a year and a half or something. And those poems, I really just started writing like as soon as, you know, sort of like again, just clinging to this little too. So, and then, you know, again, that book, it was hard to see very far out past my own sort of all-encompassing psychopathologies, you know, which were just so loud and like sort of just drowned out everything else at the time. And in the intervening years since I wrote those poems, right, I think I've gotten a little bit better at listening to the subtler gradations of experience. And again, you know, I've also, you know, fallen in love with my best friend and married them actually, in between these two books. And so, yeah, I mean, again, like there's no way to quantify it. And I actually don't think our poems themselves sound very similar. And I think that our first books probably sounded, I don't think our first books sound particularly similar, but I think that they were, even they were a little bit closer than our poems sound now. But I do think that you know, probably like the single biggest influence on the way that I write and how the way that I write has shifted over the past, you know, 5 years, has been just that quality of attention. And that is, you know, that is just, you know, almost exclusively a function of just watching Paige move through and love the world and practice, you know, the devotional act of attention, right?
Oh, what a great way of describing it, the devotional act of attention, which is another aspect of a pilgrimage, right? That's another thing that a pilgrim does is pay attention to each step on the road, pay attention to the journey and also the point of arrival.
You know, I'm and I'm so, you know, I spent so much of my life just like lurching from crisis to crisis, right? That I was just like, you know, my brain just sort of defaults into like, okay, what's next? You know, like, all right, this thing, then, you know, like what's, you know, one thing happens and then the next thing happens, you know? And Paige is so good at, I don't mean to just turn this into like a spouse, like a podcast about how much I love my spouse, but you know, I just, they're so good at like reminding me like, hey, like this is really nice. Like what is happening right now is like, this is good, you know, and like not in an effort to sort of like make it stay longer, you know. You know, not in an effort and but just to make sure that like we're not just appreciating good moments in hindsight, you know, that we're actually like there in the moment being like, wow, you know, like this is really lucky. And because we have both experienced a lot of moments that have been less lucky than this one, and we both will inevitably experience a lot of less lucky moments than this one, like we are really able to appreciate the texture of like just how good this is, right?
That's beautiful. I mean, we did in the first half talk at some length. I hope it is recoverable about the just outstanding work of M. Norbezi Phillips and those two books, Zong and the first book and the and then Paige has a relatively new book. Did it Was it published in 2022? Their new book?
There, yeah, Space Truck, I think, was 2019. So, yeah, newish.
2019.
Yeah.
It all feels it's 2019, 2022,
I think it was
2021,
2019.
like
Maybe it was
all those
20.
books kind of
Yeah, listen, I think it was 2019. Someone's gonna like Google it and this comes out and be like, no, actually, no. But I think it was 2019. I swear I love my spouse very much and I pay good attention to their, but it is one of those things where time is just kind of a flat circle.
Time is a flat circle,
Yeah.
and also I think love and praise is should be a circle as well, right? That when we're
Yeah,
talking
yeah.
about our own work, it seems perfectly appropriate to talk about the work of others who that we
Yeah.
love, other work that we love,
Yeah.
and
Yeah.
on the page and not. So that's fine with me.
Yeah.
I want to think again about this idea of the devotional aspect of attention, and we talked a little bit about that salad spinner that I love, and that the poem The Palace, which is so fascinating because that poem is there's very little like bright delight in that poem. That poem is
Yeah.
about a great deal of the difficult realities of the world and the horrid ways
Yeah.
that we treat others and the insufficiency of compassion and the reach of violence, right? And yet there's this kind of moment of mundanity in the poem that for me brings it so that we're not just talking conceptual about these faraway terrors that don't connect to me. It's the ways in which our lives are all wrapped up in those faraway terrors, that we are living our lives and other people are living their lives, and that is both the wonder and the horror of the world. Is there an object in this book, or a place in this book, or a landscape in this book, to which you were able through these poems to pay a kind of bright devotional attention that still has a gravitational pull to you, that still kind of means something to you as you consider the book at this point in its process?
That's these are such beautiful questions. I'm trying to remember them. You mentioned the salad spinner, which haunts me, truly, truly haunts me. Every time I see it in my kitchen, I'm just like, I just, you know, I mean, we use it, but I can't think of a more just, a more useless indictment of just my relative comfort, but that's sort of the opposite of what you're asking. You know what? There's a poem in this book called Reza's Restaurant, Reza's Restaurant, Chicago, 1997, which is about a Persian restaurant that I used to go to with my, or, you know, about, I'm dubious of using that word to describe poems, but it orbits this Persian restaurant that I used to go to with my family in Chicago. And ever since writing that poem, I've been to that restaurant a number of times since that's one of the older poems in the book. And ever since writing that poem, that place has really become sort of like holy to me. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, it always was kind of holy, because my family who, we never, ever, ever went out to, we would never get even like Happy Meals or whatever, it was just such a extravagance, for us. But like once a year or so, we would take these family trips to Reza's restaurant, in Chicago to get Persian food, And it was like the biggest deal to the point that like literally, I'm not exaggerating, like it's like Pavlovian to this day. The sight of the Chicago skyline like still kind of like makes me hungry, still kind of like makes my mouth, I'm not even joking about that. But yeah, so that, a number of my friends live in and around Chicago, and a lot of the times now, they've seen the poem, or they've heard me read that poem at readings or whatever, and they'll, we'll go eat at Reza's, you know. So it's become this place that I used to go to with my family, and now I go to with sort of my new family, you know, my chosen family of poets, you know. Like I've been there with Evie Ewing and Nate Marshall and Jose Olivares and Hanif, and you know, I mean, like you know, a lot of the people who I talk to most today, right, have like eaten there with me, right, and that's a really lucky thing, you know.
That sounds delightful. And also it's so interesting because that poem to me is there's much in that poem about difference and distance and how we can tell each other apart, but also how we recognize our kind and how we recognize our kin, right? And
Totally, totally.
that then becomes a place to which you bring your kin who are different in so many ways, and yet are
Total.
your kind.
Yeah, well, and I mean, like, you know, I mean, the poem begins with my dad, and this really did happen. You know, he would point around the restaurant and be like, you know, that person is actually Iranian, but that person is Arab, and that person is just white, but they kind of have a tan, and that person, you know, and he really would do that, you know, it's sort of like this like parlor trick or something, you know, being like, I can tell, you know. And it's a funny thing now because like I was born in Tehran, right? I am Iranian, but I also don't speak. I mean, you know, I lost Farsi when I came here, even though it was my first language. And though I've taken sort of lessons or whatever, you know, I'm never going to speak Farsi like a native speaker, in this lifetime. And so in a room full of Iranians, I often feel like the least Iranian person, right? In a room full of Americans, I mean, not often, I certainly feel like the least American person in a room full of Americans. And so, you know, it's also like sometimes I imagine like if I was in that restaurant, right? Like, what would my dad say about me, right? Like, would he recognize me as Iranian? You know what I mean? Like, it's just like that sort of. But I do know that, like, if I, you know, inshallah, someday you and I can go to Reza's and I'll take you there and you can join the august company of like my kin who I've who I've eaten at Reza's with, because it truly is. I remember the first time I ever took Paige to Reza's. It was like, wow, this is getting serious between us. You know what I mean? Like it was like I'm showing you, you know, I'm showing you Reza's, right? Like this is there's no takes backsies from this, you know. So, you know, yeah, it means a lot to me.
This is gonna feel like a little bit of a hop, but
Love a hop.
you love a hop. I'd love to talk about just the shape of your lines and what kind of decisions went into that. They feel very varied throughout. We talked a little bit about that disruptive syntax that runs against the grammar of the Pilgrim Bell poems, so that we'd look at those poems and they look like just your average left-aligned columnar poem, and then they're doing this other disruptive thing as you're reading them that makes you question what you thought you knew. And then you've got these other poems that kind of move across the page in different ways. I have an advanced reader's copy, so I don't know if in the final versions, the dingbats, which are boxes in mine and like my father's accent, for
Yeah,
instance, will be
they're
more
box. They stay
stylized.
boxes.
They
Yeah.
stay boxes, right? So then we have these boxes and ultrasound and my father. So like what are you thinking about like how you're shaping the poems on the page and how that helps to affect the responses to the poems?
Another beautiful and generous question. I mean, it's true, you know, like writers writing from a position of alterity tend to be asked first about the sort of social and political content of their work and then about the actual craft or the line or
If
whatever you want to
ever,
call
if
it.
ever. It's for me,
Yeah,
it's
if
like one of
ever,
the
if
most
ever.
important things is that I always
Yeah,
ask
sure.
about craft because I feel
Yeah.
like as a for, as you just said, like there's so many ways in which my poetry gets examined for subject and content and
Of course.
topicality, which is important
Of
to
course.
me. But also
Sure.
I'm a craftswoman. Like
Yeah.
the other thing
Totally.
is
Thousand
also
percent.
important. And so, yeah, so there
Thousand
you go.
percent. Yeah. Totally. Totally. Yeah. I remember talking to Solmaz about her first book, and like I was talking about like I remember there was this one poem where I think it was I think this was for our Dive Deaf interview. And we talked about like I think there was one of her poems where she was like riffing on Elizabeth Bishop, and I was really excited about this. And she was like, "Yeah, I wish more people would talk to me about that. You know, like I wish more people would talk to me about that sort of thing. You know, because she's an incredible, just like an incredible, just poet. You know, incredible. You know, maker of lines, right? But yeah. Anyways, yeah. The line in this book is interesting. It changes a lot. The one thing that recurs often is the little square dingbat. You know, the idea of the square is something that recurs again and again throughout the book. It's one of the sort of like central pieces of iconography, I guess, in the book, right? That culminates in the palace repeating, the throne, my throne is comfy and square, my throne is comfy and square. And then you have all of these squares throughout the book, and that po there's a poem called Palace Mosque Frozen that appears visually as like two squares inscribed inside each other, two squares of language. And there's the other poem that you referenced that you have to read in a mirror, which is usually like a sort of square rectangular shape. That poem cracks me up too. I just like the idea of people like having to look at themselves in a mirror while they read a poem, which is, yeah, I don't know. I mean, maybe it's a little on the nose, but you know, I think that again, to go back to that Eno quote that was in the first part of our conversation that may or may not still exist.
So repeat the
This
quote
idea.
too, just to make sure.
The idea that the Kraken, a blues singer's voice in on a vinyl record, is the excitement of witnessing an emotional event too momentous for the medium assigned to record it, too momentous for the medium assigned to record it, right? And so often in these poems, in a poem like The Value of Fear or My Father's Accent, right? I feel like I'm sort of picking up speed and picking up steam, and I'm beginning to try to say a thing, and then the hard reset of the section break of the square comes in, and sort of disrupts that, right? And in a way that is not really organic seeming, right? It's not like the clause has come to a sort of tidy end, and now we're sort of shifting our attention to another thought unit, right? The way that section breaks are often or usually sort of traditionally used in lyric poetry, right? Oftentimes, those breaks will come in the middle of a sentence, or, you know, they'll indicate a shift in person, you know, from the first to the second, or from the first person singular to the first person plural or something like this, or they'll indicate a shift in tense, right? Or it'll just be like a line repeated on both sides of a break, you know. And I think that, I don't know, there's something, you know, my friend Hanif Abdurraqib, who has, I'm sure by the time that this comes out, he'll have a new book that everyone should be reading. But he does have an amazing new book out that everyone should read. You know, he wrote a small thing about this book for the cover, and spoke about the poems. I forget exactly what he said, and this is terrible, but he said something to the effect of the poems resisting beautification and choosing ugliness, right? And I think that that's so real. And the word ugliness too, we were talking about Reza's Restaurant, and that's a word, that's a poem that kind of pulls apart that word ugliness, and sort of, I don't know, owns it, claims it. I was talking with, I remember years ago, I was talking with the poet, another transcendent American poet, the poet Vivie Francis, about the word ugly and ugliness, and like, and what it, what power can be drawn from that word. And that was one of the, I can't remember if I had that conversation just before or just after I wrote that Reza's Restaurant poem. But anyways, when I'm thinking about like the pilgrim's journey and the sort of like unselfconsciousness, you know, a pilgrim isn't showing up to the tomb of Assisi wearing Prada, you know what I mean? The pilgrim is unselfconscious in that way and not afraid of being ugly in order to sort of get the thing right, you know? And I think that allowing some of that to remain in the book, allowing some of that to remain in the line, instead of like polishing away those stutter steps and that rhetorical hesitancy, allowing that to sort of stay in the book and allowing the reader to experience the process of my trying to get it right, as opposed to just leaving the artifact of like having gotten what I am calling right. You know what I mean? I think that that's really integral to how the book works.
Yeah, and it's part of how to reveal again the process of the pilgrimage as opposed to just now I'm at the Basilica of St. Francis of Assisi. Like, no, I had to walk there, like,
It's a long walk.
yeah, and my shoes have holes in them now.
Yeah, totally, totally. Well, and not only that, but like it is the walk that is the pilgrim, right? Like the destination, you're it's no longer the pilgrimage, right? That's just where you're at, you know? And I mean like the journeys that I'm on, the journeys that I'm interested in, right? The sort of like process of learning to move through this world without harming it is horizontal, right? Like you never, it's like the horizon. You march towards it forever and you never actually get there, right? And it's the marching, it's the motion that keeps you good, right? It's the motion that keeps you better than you were the day before, right? And that's what this book is interested in, right? But I mean, like ultimately, I mean, I'm writing poems because they, it's a spiritual technology for me. I mean, I feel like every time I say something like that, people are like, oh, okay, he's not for me. You know, like I'm not a spiritual person. You know what I mean? Like I don't, you know, organized religion fucked me up or whatever, you know, and I'm not, you know, I'm as confused about God as anyone, you know, I don't know what I mean when I say that word, but I do know that I'm interested in learning to move through the world without harming it. And I think the poems help me with that.
That brings up about three questions at once for me. There's that beautiful moment where you and your brother are just trying your darndest to pray, especially you, kind of watching your own.
Oh, I think you hello?
Yeah, I'm here. Sorry.
Oh, sorry. No, you're fine. You're fine. Yeah, I'm watching my older brother. Yeah.
You're watching your older brother, and you're trying to do your duty and pray, and then your older brother does something that makes a funny sound, and then you're both just hysterical. So there is in fact belly laughter in this book, as it turns out. But that moment of kind of a deep connection coming to you that kind of disarms you both and throws you out of the ritual into something even more tender and devoted to loving, right? To loving the kind of happenstance of life, right? Like that, there's just this that moment feels so important because of what's unexpected, right? This unexpected thing comes into this ritualized to kind of dead to you process and
1,000%.
brings this connection between you and your brother and higher powers, really, like things over which we have no
absolutely.
control.
Absolutely. Well, and the moment where we are like trying to hold our shit together but just can't, and we start laughing, it is only that I'm getting goosebumps talking about this right now. This is wild. But like that moment only is as trenchant as it is, as funny, as poignant to us as it is, because of how rote the process of prayer had become. You know what I mean? Like, had prayer been like a novelty, we would have been much more interested in that, right? But because, you know, my brother's foot catching the doorstop, and it makes this like
No. Why am I losing everything?
oh,
Nothing changed.
impossibly funny. You know, like nothing else in my life will ever be as funny as that was in that moment, right? Like, that is my answer to, like, you know, a really good question to ask someone at a party is like, when was like when did you laugh the hardest in your life, you know? And that's always my answer, you know, it's like that moment. And it's because of the roteness of the prayer, because of, you know what I mean? And yeah, I mean, again, like when I say the word God, you know, I mean my brother, right? I mean my family, I mean my students, I mean Paige, I mean justice, I mean the earth, I mean the cosmos. And then I also mean an old bearded guy in the sky who gets mad when I lie. You know what I mean? And I mean all of that, right? And it's, you know, and all I have, it's the same way, like when I say I love you to Paige, right? I mean something, you know, the word love contains that. And it also contains, like, when I say, like, you know, I love this. I was eating, you know, I got a cocomelon or a watermelon from the market earlier today. And it was like really, really good. It was like my first watermelon that I've gotten while I've been here. And so I was like, I said, I texted Paige, and I was like, you know, like, I love this watermelon. And like, that's the same word that I use to tell them that I love them. And like the same word that I use to tell my cats that I love them, right? The word God is like that, right? It's just this sort of like catch-all, tidy little monosyllable, you know? And it contains all of those things. It's expansive enough to contain that. And I think that that's one of the things that this book is gesturing towards. Though, again, I'm always a little anxious that people are gonna like hear me talking about God and be like, oh, well, you know, maybe not for me. You know what I mean? Like,
Well, let's push the anxiety all the way then, because this book also really speaks to what it means to be Muslim in America and what it means to be Muslim in this world. And that too is a thing that can, if not turn people off, it's like supercharge their ire,
Yeah, totally.
right?
Totally. Love to supercharge people's ire.
So what does that mean to write at the same time that you're writing? I mean, a bunch of your metaphors here, you happen to be in Italy right now, but like a bunch of your metaphors have been about the Christian world, et cetera, like, and also kind of moving to other kinds of spaces. What does it mean to write?
I think I heard you say, what does it mean to
Yeah,
write? And then
I know, because I
you
stopped
look.
because I have to still have my, anyway, I'm back. I knew where I stopped. This is like
No,
such an adventure, and I'm sorry, whoever is
you're just
transcribing.
fine. You're just
No,
fine. Yeah, no, that's
you're
great.
fine. I'm just apologizing to the transcriber at this point.
Oh man, I didn't even think about that. Yeah, I
Sweet
apologize
nuts.
to you, transcriber. You're a saint. I I have done a lot of transcription in my day and I know how long it takes. And you can't even like have Netflix on in the background or anything while you're
No,
doing it
you
because
gotta be there. You're fully
yeah.
there. But
My
okay.
apologies and gratitude, transcriber.
So what I was asking, like way in which you're like, hello, I am a Muslim in America. And also, right, all these other ways that we're connected, all these other ways that we have, kinship and similarities and possibilities for conversations, the ways that we can translate our inner selves, in ways that are recognizable and then in ways that aren't, that was less of a question than a statement, but I bet you can go with it.
I mean, no. I mean, it's funny because that's how conversation actually works between two people.
Right.
Is like, not everything is like, here's a question, here's an answer, here's a question. You know, like sometimes you can just say a thing and then the other person says, yeah, and that makes me, but like, it's this funny thing where sometimes in things like this, you know, someone's just waiting until like something is like rhetorically framed as an interrogative, even though there's like perfectly, you know, even though like you would never do that in an actual conversation. Yeah, no, I am a Muslim. I was raised Muslim, but I even saying that is sort of like a misnomer. I think that especially in America, if you say that you were raised Muslim, people assume that you just kind of like popped out of the womb with like a hijab or, you know, a full beard or, you know, whatever, like holding a copy of the Quran. And, you know, we were Muslim, but we were like as Muslim as like a Christian family that only goes to church on Easter. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like we were pretty, I mean, you know, like I don't know that my dad has ever read the Quran. My mom has. You know, I mean, you know, there are spectrums of all these things. And it wasn't until I got sober that my relationship with this actually sort of became a little bit deeper. And I became a little bit more interested in this and, you know, started doing things like fasting for Ramadan and, you know, this sort of stuff. But I mean, and so, I say this almost as if to like sort of situate myself within Muslimness, right? Because like, you know, I'm writing from a very specific vantage point of American Muslimness, right? Like it hasn't always been as legible in my behavior as it has been for other American Muslims. And so the ways that I have move through the American space, or you know, I say this because I don't want to give the impression that I'm co-opting any experiences that are not actually my own. But that said, you know, I've had, you know, I mean, I've had the sort of like standard loadout of being called, you know, all the things that we know that Muslims get called, and you know, living through not post 9/11 sort of like reflexive jingoism and Islamophobia, and you know, there's a 1000% chance that when I fly back into the US I will be detained for some amount of time by customs. I've never not been detained flying into the US for some amount of time in my life. Like, so it's ranged from, you know, a half hour to hours, you know, and, you know, and plenty of people have stories worse than these, but just to say, like, you know, I have had a full spectrum of being, of experiences of being sort of legibly Muslim in America as well. And yeah, I mean, I guess, sorry, I'm sort of rambling. Maybe the thing that is useful to say is that I'm very aware of how the appetite for certain narratives in a neoliberal literary readership is shaped, and how if I write a narrative that's like poor little Muslim Kaveh, and everyone is being so mean to him because he's Muslim in America. You know what I mean? And like, if I write that book, people will like it. You know what I mean? Like, people won't call me out on that shit. And like, people will like it, and they'll say like, "Oh, it's so fucked up that your, ninth grade math teacher called you a sand n-word," right? Which is true. He did, right? But I've never put that in a book because it's like a sort of like pre-processed algorithm of, well, there are a number of reasons why I've never put that in a book. But one is that it's a sort of pre-processed algorithm that allows the reader to say like, I was not the one that did that to Kaveh, so I am good for feeling bad about that other guy, and I'm also good for not having been him, for not having been the person who literally did that exact thing, right? And that's not interesting to me. I'm not interested in like writing a book that allows the reader to sort of vent their neoliberal guilt in that way, to feel good about having stepped into a book and like felt a little bit bad. It's almost like an inoculation, right? Like, you feel a little bit bad reading the book, and then you leave feeling good for having felt bad, and then like nothing changes in your life, right? Like, nothing changes in your behavior. Nothing changes in the way that you think about yourself or your complicitnesses or what to do about that, right? You just feel good a little bit for having felt that little bit of bad, right? And I just don't want to do that, right? Which doesn't mean that I'm not doing that. I'm sure that I've come up short in moments, but that is what I have been trying to move against, is that sort of easy narrative of like, me, the victim, America, the big bad guy, right? That's why the salad spinner is in the palace. You know what I mean? That's like exactly what that is doing there, right? Is like, the palace is, I've talked about this before, but like, the palace is a poem in which I talk about a kid who's wearing a shirt that says, "We did it to Hiroshima, we can do it to Tehran." And as horrifying a sentiment as that is, right? Like, I live in Indiana. You know what I mean? Like, if they did literally do the action implied by that sentence, I would have family members that died. I would have beloveds that died. But my house is in Indiana. You know what I mean? And in fact, I sold that poem to the New Yorker, who paid me money for it, right? And then I wrote a book with that poem in it, and then Grey Wolf paid me money for that book. You know what I mean? Like, I just want to be, I want to be rigorous, because it is in that rigor that the easy narrative of like, America has been mean to me, and so you should feel bad for me and feel good about yourself for having felt bad, right? Like, it is in that rigor that that sort of venting of neoliberal guilt is resisted. Does that make sense?
That makes all kinds of sense. And is so crucial to trying to work towards a real understanding that may become action.
Totally. That's
Useful.
such a perfect way to say it. That's such a perfect way to say it. A real understanding that will become action, right? Because the other thing, the thing where I just tell you the horror stories of, ninth grade or TSA or whatever, that thing doesn't turn into action, right? That thing makes people think that it is the action, right? That thing doesn't, like, what I want the poems to do is to point towards the action, right? Not to convince you that they are the action, right? For Gwendolyn Brooks in Annie Allen, I think it's like the second or third poem in the Children of the Forest sequence. It's called First Fight, Then Fiddle, right? And it's like, and it's like, that's, I mean, but isn't that, I mean, that's like, like, I can't, like, everything that I've said in this conversation can be summed up in those four words, right? Like, you don't, you take care of the action. You fight, you take care of your community or your people or your work, right? And then you sort of sing about it and you don't confuse one for the other. You know, that's the critical part, right? Like, again, like, you know, I mean, I haven't been on social media and you know, any sort of social media in I don't know, over a year, but you know, that's the trap of, like, you know, tweeting a tweet that, like, inhabits the carapace of action, that does nothing, that doesn't move the needle at all, but that, like, can vent some of the responsibility of, like, actually doing something, right? That can vent the responsibility of, like, the deeply unsexy and thankless work of organizing, you know, or checking in on your neighbor or whatever, you know what I mean? The stuff that you can't, like, post a picture of on Twitter or Instagram or whatever, you know what I mean? It vents some of the sense that you should be doing that other stuff. You know what I mean?
I do, absolutely. So we're getting close to midnight in Italy, where you are right now, and I don't want to
Yeah.
keep you up forever, but will you bear with me for three more questions? Are
Absolutely,
you
absolutely. I love talking to you.
okay?
I
I
love talking to
know
you.
this is fun. I wish that we were sitting someplace. Every time we sit over some delicious meal, remember we were
I
in
know.
Portland and we
I
had
know.
that
I
glorious
do.
meal.
Yeah, that was like, yeah, totally.
After a lovely walk. So the first question that I have is what action looks like for you outside of poetry, right? Outside of literature, what are some of the ways that you live your life that feel also and kind of consecutively important to you, to the kinds of work that you're doing in your poems?
Yeah, I mean, for me, and this is such an important question because I think that my answer is different than literally every other person's in the world, as it should be, right? Because we're all sort of, like, figuring out what this action can look like. And there's a line in a Gabrielle Calvo, no, this is a Mary Carr poem, sorry, called The Voice. I apologize to Gabby Calvo-Cressy. I promise I'll, I mean, I think about and quote her poems often too, but this is in a Mary Carr poem called The Voice of God, where she says, she's talking about the voice of God and says it is small and fond and local. And I love, I just love that, small and fond and local. And then the end of the poem is like, it says the most obvious shit, put down the gun, eat a sandwich, right? Which is, you know, like, again, like, I'm always waiting for these, like, you know, surely Empire will need me to, like, you know, step in front of a tank sometime soon, right? And so, like, I'll just, like, hold off in my apartment until, like, the tank comes outside my window, you know what I mean? But no, I mean, yeah, I mean, action for me today looks like the work that I do that I don't talk about often in spaces like these in recovery, which is the majority of my work, actually, with newcomers in recovery and with fellows in the recovery community. The work that I do with people in recovery in carceral institutions, the work that I do with my students, the work that I do with my nieces, and my friends, and the poets who tug on my shirt sleeves that I'm able to help, and I wish that I could do more for more. You know, I don't know. I mean, this, you know, I don't mean to make this sound like I'm just, like, cataloging my virtues. I feel my acreage in hell sort of shrinking as I do this, or growing. How does that work? Your acreage in hell? Would it be punitive to have your acreage in hell shrink or grow? That's the,
I don't think you want more acreage in hell.
yeah, I guess so. So yeah, I think that, yeah. Yeah, but I mean, like, I guess, like, if I'm
Unless
gonna
you want to
be,
stretch out and not be stretched,
yeah,
I
I'm
don't
saying,
know.
like,
I
if
don't
I'm
know how that
gonna be,
works.
yeah, that's a, maybe I need to work on that. I need to workshop that metaphor a little bit. But yeah, you know, like, just to say, like, because I am a person in recovery who is also a poet and has some amount of institutional power, you know, the work that I'm capable of doing looks different than the work that, my friend Sivan here is able to do, who is a composer who lives in France, right? And the work that she's able to do is different than the work that my friend Yosvani is able to do, who is a Cuban musician, right? Who and da 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 da, but I think that what I learned from that Brooks poem, right, is that the work that we do, there's a line in that poem, and you'll forgive her the ableist language of her time and me for quoting it here, but there's a line in that poem where she says, "Be I don't want to fuck this up, be deaf to war and to beauty blind." No, shit. No. Sorry. No, I'm gonna. I'm, well, hold on. I'm gonna be deaf to be deaf. I'm sorry, transcriber. Can you like Google this really quickly? It's like be deaf to art and to beauty blind. Yeah, I think that's what it is. Be deaf to art and to beauty blind. Win war. Be deaf to art and to beauty blind. Win war. I'm like 95% sure that that's the line. And again, you'll forgive me for quoting the sort of ableist language of her time, but just to
Be
say,
deaf to music and to beauty blind.
be
Win war.
deaf to music and to beauty blind. I'm sorry. Thank you. Sorry, I didn't want to like just be on my computer while we're talking and looking things, but I wanted to be present in this conversation. Yeah, but yeah, be deaf to music and to beauty blind. Yeah, that makes more sense than being deaf to art. be deaf to music and to beauty blind, win war. And yeah, I think that the idea of just knowing which one is which, you know what I mean? Like just knowing when it's time to take the call from a fellow in recovery and not resenting it because it's pulling me away from some book that I'm reading, or you know what I mean? And yeah, I mean, if I the work that I do also takes the form of like taking out my cat litter and keeping those mammals that depend on me alive, as I don't have kids, but I know a lot of parents in my life whose the work that they do and the work that you do over this past year, it's been pretty Herculean too,
It was an adventure.
I truly cannot relate. Like I have no experiential reference.
Which is, I think it's one of the things that also strikes me as interesting in this book that it does. I'll be curious as this book makes its way in the world and has more readers, how many read it as another ledger of the journey of recovery in the way that people did with Calling a Wolf a Wolf, which that book really, that first book really requested in a certain sense.
Totally.
But when you were talking about your marriage with Paige and how they help you to stop and be present and really appreciate the moments you're in, I thought, well, what a wonderful partner to be in recovery with, because that's so important to be able
Totally,
to stop.
totally.
It's so important for all of us to be able to stop, and it is particularly important when we're hungering or we're dealing with what it means to hunger for something that may do us harm. Even if it will give us temporary pleasure, right? To be able to stop with what we where we are right now and find the beauty in that. And that stage of recovery seems to be really active to me in Pilgrim Bell, like that reckoning, that willingness to admit faults.
Totally,
To
totally.
admit like a lack of expertise and an inability to correct all things and fix all things, like all that seems to be deeply inscribed in this text. And so I do wonder if people will read this as a later stage recovery ledger also. And
That's
yet to
beautiful.
me, it feels like it is also. It's just a survival guide for all of us. It's a way that all of us move through life with attention and awareness, which means letting in the horrors and the violence of the world that we've kind of spoken to at some points along this conversation, as well as the beauty and the grace. What it was that Hanif says in your book, I'm just reading from the back cover, but what thrilled me most about this book was another commitment, the commitment to writing discomfort or ugliness, doing it well and doing it without insisting upon beautification. And I think what Hanif means in that, without insisting upon beautification, is what you've talked to about a couple times. Like, I'm going to give you the messy part as well as what the final answer was, and I'm not just going to leap to the final answer, or I'm not going to clean up and not reveal this kind of messy aspect or ugly aspect of the story that I'm telling you, just to get to this shining moment, or what we've talked about is the pilgrimage with the holes in the shoes is the actual pilgrimage, not arriving at the gorgeous basilica, right?
Totally.
All of that to
Totally.
me seems to be, circling back to why this book, why the act of writing a book like this then may be useful to you and necessary to you. You spoke in the first half of like that your first book, you were just writing while on a couple of planks, like a life raft, and that this one felt different because you are able to be more grounded. So I'm going to make this my final question because we've been talking for so long and probably already have way more than enough information. But like, it's the question that I kind of hate most when people are talking to me, because I'm usually in a kind of muddy place, and I'm also trying to think about a book as a complete object, even though I'm usually a little bit away from the port of that book. I'm starting out to see again,
Of
right?
course. Of
You
course.
know,
Of course.
but what are the things in this book that you feel at this moment? Like, can you name one thing? Let's just say, can you name one thing in this book that you feel in this moment? Yes, that hope has been realized. I have really, I've done that thing. And another thing, can you name another thing where you think, the next path of my journey may be to try to figure out how to realize that? Like, I was working towards this, but I don't know if I've fully gotten it yet.
That's beautiful. Wow. Yeah, there's, the palace is the longest poem that I've ever written. And it was a poem that it's the only poem that I've ever written this way, as like, it was a time in my life when I was very, very, very busy. I was teaching a lot and traveling a lot. And I just sort of had this document across my, you saw, I can't even remember like what stage of life this was when you saw it, but it lived as a Pachacucha for a while. I mean, it had a billion different forms in its life. And it was something that like I would write like a line or a couple lines one night and then delete them the next night and write another line and and then delete that the next night and write it. It was just something to like keep me like at least writing like a thing a day, even if that thing was just like an image or something. And then the process of like deleting those other lines made it so that it was almost like this accretion, like this sort of, and because of that process, like Penelope at her loom, she would like go and, weave a strand, I don't know, loom language, but she would weave a little bit and then like undo what she had woven the previous day or whatever, And so there are all these sort of like references in the poem to other parts of the poem that aren't even in the poem anymore, and so it has this sort of like weird private idiom with itself, which I really, I don't know, there's something about it that just like does more for me than what language is supposed to do. And it feels like, yeah, it feels like that poem really works for me. Like a poem has taught me a lot about like what I was and am trying to do with poetry. I learned a lot from that. And again, like it's the only poem I've ever written that way. I haven't tried to write another one that, it's just, it was like a sort of one-off thing. But in terms of more growing along these lines, there's a golden shovel in the book that is, a form invented by Terence Hayes, paying homage to Gwendolyn Brooks, who we've talked a little bit about already. But there's a golden shovel that is like I don't even know. It's like a double. I don't know if this is like a thing. Denez called it. I forget. Denez saw a version of it and called it. God, I want to remember what they called it. They called it like a golden, like rake or something. They like dubbed. They dubbed it something because it's like a golden shovel, like down one side and up the other side. Like it's the phrase on like the phrase appears on both
On both
sides of the
sides.
poem. Yeah, and it's a line from the Quran. And there was something in writing that I've actually written, that's the only one that made it into the book. I mean, this book could have been twice as long. One of the things that I wanted was a lean book, like a very sort of tight, compressed book. There were enough poems to make this book, in fact, quite a bit more than twice as long. But I wrote a lot of those like two-sided golden shovels. I wish I remembered what Dinesh called it because it was the perfect thing. It wasn't golden rake, but it was something really clever and funny. But I wrote a bunch of them and they were all bad, except for I like the one that is in a book. I think it works. But there was something in the process of writing them that, and every, I'm like the last person in the world, the last poet in the world to discover this. But like when you're working in a sort of received form, it forces you to use language that you wouldn't ordinarily think to use, right? And it forces you to sort of twist your language in ways that you wouldn't ordinarily think to twist. And there was something in that double golden shovel form that felt particularly sort of like when we're talking about devotion, attention as a form of devotion, extracting language from the Quran to really meditate on that way, to like sort of find these pieces of ligature between these like just little syntactical units within these phrases felt really, really, really powerful and illuminating for me. And I haven't returned to writing those, but that's something that I would like to. I mean, again, like I have no idea. Like the other ones that I wrote didn't make it in a book and never will. I'll never publish them. And I might write 50 more that I'll never publish, but there was something in that that felt really interesting and useful for me, and just sort of spending that deep time with that language. And so that's maybe something that I'd like to keep exploring.
I love that idea.
Yeah, that
Yeah.
was that. I kind of actually forgot about all those extra poems. Maybe I should go back and see if there's anything there to compost and put in a better poem.
Well, I mean, and it sounds like that with Palace, you're already doing a lot of
Yeah,
that kind of
totally.
pulling things
Totally.
out, and so that can be,
Totally.
That was my version of what are
1,000%.
you doing next or what are you working on now? Because
Yeah,
I
that's
like
good. That's
that
good.
version of that question always stumps me, but
Yeah.
that like
Yeah, totally.
where you could go next with what,
Yeah, I love
it's a
that.
beautiful thing to know in a sense that there's always the next work to be done,
Yeah.
right? We close a
And that's a
book and
very, yeah.
go ahead.
It's a very generous, I was just gonna say, it's a very generous way to frame that question.
I try to be generous.
I know you do. I know you do.
That's
You're very known for this.
one of the ways that I like to do my work in the world. This
Yeah.
was it was such a delightful conversation. I
Yeah,
am not
yeah.
entirely sure what's going to happen. So I think what I'm going to do is get off with you now and kind of try and remember some of the little things that we talked about in that first 45 minutes and I think it'll be fun. And then when we get a transcription, done, I will send it to you and we can kind of make sure that things look like, you weren't delirious at midnight and saying things you didn't want to
Yeah,
say or
sounds
anything
great.
like
Sounds
that.
great. Sounds great.
But let's talk again and not make it
Yeah,
just
absolutely.
enforced because we're doing a interview. I just would
I would
love,
love that. I would
I
love that.
always love
Yeah,
hearing how you're
I love
doing.
talking to you. And I'm so grateful to you. Seriously, like I mean, it really does feel altogether fitting and proper that you were, among the very first people to spend time with this book and to talk to me about it. And it just feels very lucky to me, to be the beneficiary of your attention. So thank you for that. And inshallah, we can do this again, at some point in the not too distant future about, your next book for somewhere. I haven't done Dive Dapper in years, but, I still talk to people,
Well, that will be delightful to be able to do that as well.
Yeah, and
And
so, and so.
okay. All right.
All right.
Talk to you at some point.